TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports,
baby!
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chops.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live at www.tsn1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website with the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com. Big show ahead for you this afternoon. Coming up in about 30 minutes' time, the general manager of the Detroit Red Wings, Ken Holland, is going to join us. A little bit later on in the program, around 1:30 this afternoon, Anthony Sanfilippo, he's the beat writer for the PhiladelphiaFlyers.com, is going to be on with us. And then at 2 o'clock this afternoon from the Vancouver province, Ben Kuzma is going to join us. Before then, we get right into last night's Jets-Penguins game, a 4-2 Winnipeg Jets victory that did not seem like it was going to be a realistic option after the first period. Gentlemen, how did the Jets turn it around? How did the Jets pull off that 4-2 victory?
Well, good afternoon, first of all, to both of you guys. And yeah, it's unbelievable how quickly the game turned around yesterday. Claude Noel himself said that he was just happy with the way they responded after the first 15 minutes. Watching that game in the first period, you know, Sidney Crosby's debut, obviously, after, you know, being injured last year and not playing in Winnipeg when the Pittsburgh Penguins came to town. But early on, Sidney Crosby looked like he was toying with the Jets defenseman out there. The first goal was a nicer goal, and then the second goal, Pavlik probably wishes that he had that one back. Mark Stewart gave him a little bit too much room in his own end, and Sidney Crosby made the Jets pay. But early on, it was all Pittsburgh, and the Jets responded. And if you look at the guys that contributed, it was the top line again. And in Washington, the new line of Vander Kane, Olli Jokinen, and Blake Wheeler again got the job done. Byfuglien got a goal on the power play. That was a huge goal. I mean, the Jets completely turned the tide of that game. The momentum in that game switched. For anybody that was there listening, you could hear a needle drop after Crosby got that second goal, and you know the Jets scored early in the second period, and the complexion of that game completely changed. And one of the things I really liked about that game again is Andrew Ladd, Brian Little, and Nikolai Antropov. You've changed one guy on that line, that being Blake Wheeler, and now all of a sudden that line is really clicking. I thought Brian Little was one of the best forwards out there. Andrew Ladd had a very strong game after he actually wasn't that strong on the road trip in Boston and Washington. So really it was a complete team effort, and they didn't panic. When the Pittsburgh got up, I think last year's Jets, they were panicked. This year they kept their composure, and they really turned a game around that could have really turned into a blowout.
Even though the Jets were down 2-0 after the first, I didn't think that they played all that poorly in the first period, especially that Kane, Jokinen, and Wheeler line. I thought that a sign of maybe things to come in the game is that the Pittsburgh defense just couldn't handle them on the forecheck.
Yeah, you mentioned that, Drew. The forecheck is important, obviously, for that line because you have size, and all three of those guys are big boys. You also have speed. I think that's another thing. I thought the Jets played, from what I saw, and I didn't see the entire game. I saw the middle of the game. The Jets are skating yesterday, and when the Jets skate, they're a better team. You know, it sounds simple, but you have speed elements to this squad and guys that can't keep up. Evander Kane gets from, you know, 0 to 60 in like a half a second.
Yeah.
And Blake Wheeler can skate, and Brian Little can skate. And so you put pressure on the opposing team. So the forecheck is not only a size component, it's a speed component. And I think you're exactly right about that. And I think another point is Pittsburgh's defense, and we'll look at the Pittsburgh perspective later on in future shows, but the Pittsburgh defense, as it currently is, consists of an assortment of players that I don't think can take the team to the promised land without a few additions via trade or from the minor leagues.
You've still got, Drew, they've still got Chris Letang, and they've obviously still got Brooks Orpik. Brooks Orpik is, you know, one of the best stay-at-home defensemen in the NHL, tough as nails. But you're talking about the 2009 Stanley Cup winning team, and you don't have Rob Scuderi and Hal Gill. Those were defensive guys that they've tried to replace with Paul Martin. But just quickly on the point of Evander Kane's speed that Richie was talking about, everyone saw the goal that Evander Kane scored against Washington where he passed the puck to himself.
Yeah, chipped it past John Carlson and then broke down the left wing there.
And that was such a great example of his speed. But another example of his speed yesterday was in the second period, Evander Kane... the puck was dumped in and, by Evander Kane, and he chased after it. And Derek Englund actually took a penalty. And I tweeted this out. It was a complete result of Evander Kane's speed and him putting pressure on the defenseman. And that he's the type of player that can create turnovers in the offensive zone. And he's a special player. Evander Kane was the best player on the ice yesterday. I mean, Crosby was good, and Malkin was good too, but you got to give Kane respect. He's becoming an elite player.
I think one thing we can't overlook also is just Andrei Pavlik's play, because the Jets have, we said it on the show last week or 2 weeks ago in terms of how the Jets perform this year. To me, it's especially with Zach Bogosian, it's can they produce offensively? I know the simple way to look at it is, well, you score 4 goals in Washington, you score 4 goals last night, you win. But it's that important to me. The Jets, with the current roster and with the defensive liabilities that they have on the back end, to me have to score to win. They're not going to win 2-1 games very often, even 3-2 games. You've got to be able to score. And so they have the past two games, and they've had success, but they've also kept teams off the board, I think more so by goaltending than by defensive system. Pavlik, from what I said, in the second period last night, the Jets obviously took the lead, went into the intermission up 3-2. But Pavlik made a few saves on odd man rushes and defensive breakdowns that really turned the tide. And if he can continue to play that way, and obviously they're going to ride him out right now. He's played the first 4 games.
It'll be interesting to see if he plays tomorrow against the Islanders or not. But
well, the Islanders are Montoya's obviously old team, and that works both ways. He knows them well. They know him well. It is the kind of game that you'd cherry pick out for him to play a weaker team and get him into the groove a bit before you go on the road. But they may hold off on that and play him in the back-to-back at the end of the week. So
that's right.
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see. But Pavlik's play is vital, and this team defensively, especially on defense, because defense is a team game. But especially on defense, I mean, you still have Byfuglien wandering a bit, and the lower pairings haven't played poorly, but they still are. They still, to me, are liabilities.
Yeah, they're soft on the puck. I mean, Grant Clitsam on that first goal that Crosby scored yesterday was just they're a little bit soft, a little bit sloppy in their own zone. And I mean, it's to be expected, really, because I mean, obviously the offensive talent for the Penguins is better than the Jets' defensive talent in that situation. It happens. I mean, no fault, no criticism really there, just, fact as it is. Mm-hmm. Now, you do see progression from Klitsam and Postma as they go forward, but, you do definitely can still see their defensive shortcomings.
For me, Postma's game is offense, obviously, and I think he needs to get the confidence. So, I think it's a good decision by Claude Noel to stick with him and allow him to, his first game, he didn't look great. You don't pull him out immediately. You give him a couple games, and you see what he's got. And what happens is it takes a few games for a guy like Paul Postma to adjust the speed of the game. Will he ever be a dominant player? No, but he adjusts to the speed of the game. And I think when he adjusts to the speed of the game, then his puck control and his decision-making becomes much improved game after game. And it may not be great because sometimes the speed gets to him, but it's better. And so I like how Noel didn't pull the trigger and say, oh, not a great game, you're out, I'm throwing somebody else in. Instead, he said, let me give this kid a little bit of time. He's worked hard. He's worked hard in the dub. He's worked hard in the AHL. I like when coaches don't say, well, here's 1 or 2 games, and boom, you're out of there.
Don't press the panic button is really what it boils down to a lot in that case. And to Paul Postma's credit, he has played better each game since the Ottawa home opener. Now, when you Paul Postma up against Sidney Crosby is a problem. He's never going to be able to handle Sidney Crosby, no matter how long he plays in the NHL. It's just a talent disparity there.
Not many guys can.
Agreed. Not many guys can, and you can almost probably say that to a lot of even the best defensemen in in the league.
That goes both ways last night, though, and you saw on the third goal of the night, Little, Ladd, and Andropov, the Lovejoy-England pair couldn't keep up, especially wide when Little took England wide.
Let's talk about the Pittsburgh defense, because if there's one thing that was a glaring weakness last night for the Pittsburgh Penguins, it's that their third and fourth defensemen and their fifth and sixth defensemen just can't cut it against high-level offensive talent. And, I mean, the Jets are a good offensive team, but they would not jump to mind as being one of the powerhouses offensively in the NHL. But, I mean, Paul Martin, Matt Niskanen just couldn't handle it. And as the second pairing, never mind the Ben Lovejoy third pairing there.
And, you know, we talked about the cup-winning team of 4 years ago, but who's not there? You look at their team, who's not there? Zdeněk Mihalík is not there.
But Zdeněk Mihalík is not there from last year's team.
Exactly.
You're right.
Well, so... That tells you right there how big of a loss he's been for that team. Mm-hmm. You know what? Pittsburgh, they lost to the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's too early to get too excited here, but they've lost two games in a row with all that offensive talent. And the thing is, even though the Penguins lost yesterday, you look at the top line of Kunitz, Dupuis, and Crosby, and you look at the second line with Malkin and Neal and Kennedy, and they're still a fantastic team. Mm-hmm. Vokoun played well, even though he let in three goals, one empty netter. But the defense is a huge question mark. The Pittsburgh Penguins every year now are going for the Stanley Cup. This isn't a team that's, you know, getting into the playoffs hoping they get the eighth seed and maybe, you know, win a couple of rounds. They're going for the Stanley Cup every year with the players they have. And right now, I would agree. I mean, Chris Letang, one of the best offensive defensemen in the NHL, but there's a huge gap there without Zdeněk Mihalík. And Paul Martin, you know, former New Jersey Devil, he does a good job, but Zdeněk Mihalík defensively was a top defenseman in the NHL, kind of quietly underrated. I know Richie really likes him, but maybe that was why people started to notice him a little bit more. But there is a huge gap there on defense for the Pens.
And he struggled a little bit in the system in Pittsburgh vis-a-vis the system he played in Phoenix.
You're talking about Zdeněk Mihalík again.
Yeah, Zdeněk Mihalík. But even so, I agree, you know, he's a real good defensive defenseman who can man up on the right side on the second pairing. Obviously, what happens there is Niskanen gets elevated to that role. Matt Niskanen is a nice puck mover, not the biggest guy, and not great defensively.
They got Niskanen in the James Neal trade from Dallas in exchange for Alex Goligoski.
That's right.
Along that line, there's a lot of talk that the Penguins are looking for is another top six winger. From what I can see, if the Penguins don't upgrade that defense, that's going to be their downfall come playoff time.
I agree with you.
They're not the wings aren't a problem. Eric Tangrady hasn't really worked out there, but you know, Joe Vitale, I kind of like his game, and you know, Tyler Kennedy is the type of guy. He always seems to give them good secondary scoring, as does Chris Kunitz, and you know, Craig Adams always fills that third line role. You know, obviously Tanner Glass gives them the grit element that they lost with Asham, but it's the Pittsburgh Penguins' offense is not the problem. Their goaltending is not the problem. It's those top three defense pairings. We know they're good on the top pairing, but that was the key thing in yesterday's game. The Jets exploited that.
Exactly, and to their credit, when you can exploit that when you're on home ice and you can get the matchups that you want. Yep. And that's what, you know, the Jets were able to do. Full credit, full marks to the Jets for pulling off that win yesterday. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to talk about it very much right now. We are on again tomorrow from 3 till 6 filling in for Hustler and Lawless before the Islanders game. But they have to match last night's intensity tomorrow night against the Islanders, because if they overlook the Islanders like the Leafs did couple nights ago, and you end up losing on home ice to the Islanders, really the win against Pittsburgh is all for naught. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to look back at the week that was for the Winnipeg Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment of the program is brought to you by David Carr of Monopoly Realty. Buying and selling a house is one of the most important and stressful life experiences. It's not an experience to be undertaken by yourself or left in the hands of a rank amateur. David Carr of Monopoly Realty takes the stress out of your real estate experience while you are secure in the knowledge that a true real estate professional is looking after your transaction. David Carr of Monopoly Realty, 230-6129. David Carr of Monopoly Realty, one more time, 230-6129. Gentlemen, last Saturday, shortly, probably about 5 hours from now, 6 hours from now, last Saturday, things did not look that good for the Winnipeg Jets. They really laid an egg at home to the Ottawa Senators. It's amazing what a week can do and how quickly things can change in a week. Given the other three games that they played, the tie against the, or the shootout loss against the Boston Bruins that really all things being equal, they probably should have won.
It was a Brian Little post away from being an extra point.
Yeah, well, absolutely, and they should have won, especially given all the power plays they had in overtime.
I mean, if we're going to say it's the post for Little, what about the five post exactly. Boston has?
That's true. Well, I tweeted out, I think it's ridiculous. I was watching the game. I watched the first period, but I was actually at work, so I PVR'd the game and had to watch it after, as a lot of people in Winnipeg were, because it was an afternoon game, Martin Luther King Day. But the post, I tweeted this, the post isn't necessarily, that's not necessarily luck or... The post is missing. I know the post is close, but it's not a goal. Anyways, I think the whole post thing, the goaltender thanks the post. Yeah, of course he does, because there is his best friend. Sometimes, you don't ever want it to go off the post. But I think it's funny. A post, isn't that not just not a goal?
Well, it doesn't count as a shot, actually, in the statistics.
There you go.
But at the same time,
it's still close.
The goal, if you speak to a goalie, he'll tell you, well, I had the angle, and he had to shoot it there, and he, there's obviously no space. And if you talk to a player, say, I got a little unlucky or an inch there, and I would have scored. In any event, Drew, a point in Boston, all in all, isn't a bad thing.
No, a point in Boston you'll take gladly. Then in Washington, one of the most complete games from the Winnipeg Jets since they've returned to Winnipeg, I would say.
Yes.
Granted, Washington was bad. So, I mean, it's not like the Jets, dominated their opponent. Washington certainly helped matters by really not showing up for that game. But still, that's no fault to the Jets. You still have to step on their throat when you see a weakened opponent.
Well, I think also, Drew, I mean, what happened, although Washington has struggled since then and before, but... One thing I noticed around the league, and others have pointed to it as well, is the team struggling in their home openers.
Right.
That was a home opener for Washington.
Yeah. I mean, but the kudos to the Jets. I mean, Washington opened the scoring there. Matt Hendricks had that, questionable goal. I thought it was a bit
of a kick. That, to me, wasn't a goal.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into it too much, but to me, it looked like that was a distinct kicking motion. But obviously, Chris King knows better than me.
Yeah.
Mike Murphy, sorry.
Yeah, I thought it was as well. Mike Murphy reviewing it in NHL headquarters, of course. But the Jets, after that first goal, really took the action to Washington. And again, you mentioned the speed of the Jets compared to, yesterday against Pittsburgh. The speed of the Jets was also a factor against Washington in that game, where Washington's defense, not the fleetest of foot, just couldn't handle the Jets through when they had speed through the neutral zone.
Guys, in those two back-to-back games, going against a very good Boston team, a team that could easily finish second or third in the Eastern Conference this year. Again, they're perennial contenders in the Eastern Conference, obviously with the Cup a few years back. But you have those back-to-back games, which the Jets were not good at last year, and they weren't good on the road at all last year. You steal a point, if you want to look at it like that, in Boston, because they didn't get the win, but they still got a point. Good effort. Played well. But then you go into Washington, and to me, that looked like a veteran team playing a smart road game, where you get the lead and you protect the lead after Evander Kane got his really nice goal and put them ahead, and Blake Wheeler got a nice goal. It looked like that team was protecting the lead. They didn't panic. They didn't do what they did last year, which was give up a lot of leads on the road when they got the lead. And the Jets were a team, I don't have the stat in front of me right now, but the Jets scored the first goal a lot last year. And they unfortunately couldn't keep leads, but they held on to the lead. And I guess that's something that maybe the Jets are not given enough credit for, is how fast they are and the players they have. But you look at the guys they have on defense, and how they're exploiting other teams' defenses, and the Jets are getting a lot more respect for themselves the way they're playing. Look at the teams they've just played: Washington, Boston, and Pittsburgh, and they've picked up five out of a possible 6 points.
I mean, against three teams that you would, prior to the season starting, and even to this day, you could reasonably see as playoff contenders. Obviously, Washington has got a bit of an asterisk next to them right now, given their performance throughout the beginning of this season. But if you can take 3 out of 4 points against Boston and Pittsburgh, two teams that are easily in the upper echelon of the Eastern Conference, you can't be anything but happy about that.
And when you're playing against Washington in a year that it's intra-conference play and specifically more division-heavy, that's a huge game.
That's right. Every game you play where you're playing a divisional opponent, if you just look at the Jets' record last year in division, they were probably the best of the.
They were 14-6-4,
which is probably,
I remember that stat because it's pretty.
It's a pretty good record.
That's
a pretty good record. You do something similar to that this year, in the Southeast, you're going to be right up there to win that division and get that one of the top three seeds in the Eastern Conference.
And if you get a top three seed with the way the team plays at home,
it's you're right.
And Richie, we're not trying to, you know, unrealistically raise the expectations of Jets mm-hmm. fans, but in those three games, I mean, they deserve to win all three of those games. I mean, it's not like the Jets got lucky here. Pavlik stole the game. I mean, the Jets played well. You got to give them credit. The season's early here. We don't want to look too much into it. Sure, the Jets are in a playoff position now. What really matters is where the Jets are in March and April. But, I mean, they're playing well right now, and you got to talk about that, and you got to give that respect.
I don't think they deserve to win Boston. I thought they were outplayed, and I thought they got fairly lucky on a couple plays, and goaltending was pretty good. I thought enough. Over their breakdowns defensively, I thought were troublesome in that game. And I thought Boston, if they had buried some of their chances, would have won that game going home. But they didn't, and that's what happened. But the other two games, I think they absolutely deserve to win. I think they played really well. And, you know, so much happens when you win, because not confidence is the key to everything. And it's not only confidence. What happens in it's not only confidence of the players, excuse me. It's confidence of the coach. I mean, Claude Noel can't be the most confident coach. He's never coached at the NHL level before. The team had an okay season last year, but there's nothing really to indicate.
Still learning his team.
But nothing really
he's
to
still
indicate.
Still learning about his team, sorry.
Yeah, that he is, you know, he's the top-flight NHL coach. Not a bad coach, but a top-flight. And we don't know yet. But the point is, when you're Claude Noel, and you know you make a couple line changes, and they seem to work out, and you've stuck with a couple guys, and it seems to have worked out. And I know you're only 2-1-1, but if you can get on a little bit of a streak, not only do the players get confidence, Coach Noel gets confidence. And I think that's really important going forward, because your coach needs to have command. And he's changed a couple things, too, which I think we should talk about. He hasn't really decided really not to criticize players in the media. I think that's something that the organization is focused on. And I think that, you know, because he takes Kyle Wellwood out, but doesn't, you know, he talks about him, but doesn't.
He praises it. He said, you know, Kyle's played well the first couple of games, but I think we just want him to get a bit of a rest. I mean, there was no, whether or not he believes it or not, from all, you know, his words tell us that, you know, he's not going to be as critical as he was. And yesterday he was interviewed by Ray Ferraro of TSN prior mm-hmm. to the puck drop. And he said, and sort of, you know, as part of the interview, is, you know, you're very quotable, and last year your press conferences had sort of become an event. And I think Noel himself acknowledged in the interview that he didn't want to become a sideshow. He didn't want to become a focal point for, you know, what's Claude going to say after tonight's game? Oh my God, that's the most exciting part. So he's, like, to your point, he has toned down on the sort of public persona. Still very funny, still very mm-hmm. personable, but less quote-worthy on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Richie, I think what you're talking about is fairly important. This is year two for Noel and year two for the Jets in Winnipeg. And let's be honest, last year was all about the Jets 2.0, the first year and all that. But you're right. It should be mentioned, Kyle Wellwood came into training camp late. He came in later than other players, and that could have factored in the whole out of shape thing. I think it's time to put that to bed. Kyle Wellwood is I believe 29 years old now. He's been in the NHL for 7 or 8 years. He is what he is right now. Let's not. He's not Mr. America Fitness here. So let's. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he is what he is. You know, that's when people bring that up about 3 years ago in Vancouver. Okay, it's enough with that. But I think it's important that Claude Noel, is getting more confident in himself. And as far as the press conferences, okay, I just hope that he remains himself, because he's a great quote.
Before we go to break, I think one thing that, again, cannot be overlooked is the addition of Perry Perrin to this coaching staff. I think that has been very important to the way this team has played on the ice and to the way the coaching staff handled themselves and the attention to detail.
Let's leave it there. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Ken Holland, the Detroit Red Wings general manager. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Past the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And the website for your latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the general manager of the Detroit Red Wings, Ken Holland. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us.
No problem. Nice to be with you.
Mr. Holland, let's start with the, you know, this being the lockout shortened year. You were around for the 94-95 season, and obviously remember that as it relates to the play on the ice. Do you see the more successful teams this season being, you know, slanting towards the offensive side or the defensive side in terms of style of play?
Well, I think, you know, first off, 94-95, I think there was a bigger disparity between the better teams and the weaker teams. I think now, when you look at the parity in the National Hockey League, everybody believes they have a chance to make the playoffs. And I think that if you look around some of the scores, there seems to be more goal scoring right now. And I just think that has something to do with a little bit of rust. I think as we go along here, there's going to be a little more attention to detail, and it's going to get a little harder to score goals. But you see a lot of 5-3, 6-3 scores that, you know, in a normal 82-game season, when you've had an opportunity to have 8 preseason games and the coaches get to implement their systems, teams are a little tighter defensively, less scoring chances. And I think that we're going to eventually get there. But I think right now, like I said, I think it's a little more wide open, and there's been more scoring chances and more goals.
Ken, obviously this past summer, you've been asked about this many times, Nicklas Lidström decided to retire. And back in 2006, Steve Yzerman did the same, both captains at the time. How are the retirements of Lidström and Yzerman different and similar, you know, with respect to their effect on the team?
Well, probably similar. I mean, I think that obviously both, you know, great players, great leaders. You know, the on-ice generals for our team, you know, maybe when Steve retired, the injuries he had to his leg, you know, were affecting, where his game was at. Obviously, Nick Lidström has had real good luck with injuries throughout his career. And I really think Nick Lidström, I think, finished fifth in voting last year for the Norris Trophy. And had he have been healthy the last 20 games, you know, maybe would have finished higher in voting. So, Nick is leaving the game when he still is one of the top 5, 6, 7 defensemen in the world. So obviously that's been a big blow. And obviously when Steve Yzerman retired in 2006, we had Nick Lidström. You know, now, Nick Lidström's retired and we don't have Yzerman, but, you know, Henrik Zetterberg did a great, you know, real good time in his career. He's 31 years of age. He's our new captain. He's been mentored and learned under and watched Steve Yzerman and watched Nick Lidström. So we've also think with Pavel Datsyuk and Nick Cronwell, who are the assistants, we've got three guys there that know how we do it, like to do things with our team, and they're good role models on and off the ice. And hopefully the transition can be somewhat smooth, but obviously there's parity and our defense, we used to have stars back there with Lidström 2 years ago, Rafalski and a real good pro and Brad Stewart. And we really lost 3/4 of our top 4 defense from 2 years ago. So I think that's going to take us a little time to sort out exactly what we've got on the back end.
Ken, Thomas Holmstrom may not have fit the prototypical effective player if you asked a lot of scouts, but that really doesn't matter because he was an effective player for so many years for your hockey club, and he obviously retired this year, announced his retirement recently. How did Thomas manage to be such an effective player for so long?
Well, you know, first off, tons of will, tons of determination, fearless, and then I think he understood what he needed to do to be effective. And, you know, I think that coming out of 05, the work stoppage, I think, you know, some people felt that maybe he wasn't going to be able to adjust because the game was going to be opened up. But Homer finds a way to win one-on-one puck battles. And, you know, probably his most important time to us was you know, after 2005, when he was getting into his 30s, he was up placed on a line with Zetterberg and Datsyuk, and you know he can protect the puck. He had good hands. He got the puck in the hands of Zetterberg and Datsyuk, and he immediately knew where to go. He went to his office to the front of the net, and he caused havoc and distracted the goalie. And you know, obviously on the power play, his hand-eye coordination to tip pucks that are in the air, and the ability to cause havoc and distract the defenders and the goaltender were I think he's one of the best of his era. Ryan Smith is another name that comes to comes to mind. But certainly, you know, if you're going to win consistently, you need good special teams. And for a long time, we were always top five on power play and top five in penalty killing. And Thomas Holmstrom was a big part, along with Nick Lidstrom. They were two-fifths of a good power play.
You're listening to TSN 1290, and we're joined by Ken Holland, the Detroit Red Wings general manager. Mr. Holland, the Red Wings are known for taking their time in player development. You know, as a general manager, how do you balance keeping a more talented but green rookie in the minors versus a veteran who may not have that rookie's talent but has a more predictable performance level at the NHL level?
Well, you know, first off, I would say to you, it's philosophy. You know, I spent 9 years in the American Hockey League, and when I played, I was in the Hartford Whaler organization, the Red Wing organization, and they were organizations that weren't very good. In the minute a young player showed some, you know, some hope, up they went. More often than not, they ended up coming back out of the minors, and they had lost their confidence, and it was a time to rebuild them all over again. So my experience being a minor league goaltender, added in with the time that I spent with Scotty Bowman, who loved veteran players, really, I guess, reinforced to me that it's a man's league, it's the best league in the world, and you know, some people are ready to play in this league at 19, and some people aren't ready to play until they're 23 and 24. So we've had the luxury that through the years that we've had good teams, there hasn't been pressure to rush people. We don't pick very high, so it's not like we've had to make decisions on people, you know, should we leave them in junior, should we put them on the NHL team, but you know, and the other thing is we've tried to have good depth in our organizations, and a lot of times you have younger people playing in the minors, and they're honing their skills. At times they don't like it, but I like to set it up so that when a player gets to the National Hockey League, he's got the foundation in the NHL for 10 or 12 years, and he doesn't go back to the American League. It doesn't work 100% of the time, but obviously we've had the luxury to be patient. And I think wherever you can, you like to let young players develop.
And we were talking before the break, and we're based out of Winnipeg. We were talking before the break how we seem to we view Claude Noel as having matured a little bit since last season. In terms of the Detroit, can you talk about Mike Babcock and the difference maybe in any of his styles compared? Basically, looking back and saying, you know, how has Mike Babcock changed from when we hired him just after he was let go in Anaheim to where you're at today?
Well, I think when Mike came in 2005, you know, we had a lot of debate. Mike really wanted us to play, you know, a north-south type of game. I mean, that's what he had coached in juniors. That's what he had coached really in the American Hockey League. And I don't think he had coached, you know, the caliber of talent that we had had, you know, when he had, you know, when he came in, we had Yzerman and Shanahan and Chelios and Lidstrom and, you know, young Cronwall and young Zetterberg and Datsyuk and, I don't know, Mike Samuelson and there was some others. And you know, we had played a puck possession game. And I think that, you know, over the course of the first couple of months of his first year, he started to appreciate the importance of puck possession. Now, you got to have a certain style of player to play puck possession, too. And I think the other thing which Mike has really evolved in is in dealing with players, he pushes them, but he's learned when to back off, when to give them space. You know, he gets, you know, obviously when you've got a leader like Yzerman and a leader like Lidstrom and now Zetterberg, he gets their input on travel, on, you know, should you have a day off, you know, should it be a short practice? He gets their input where, you know, early on he came with, as a young coach, with, you know, his own philosophies, and now he takes a little more input from those people around him. But you know, we're lucky. I think we've got one of the best coaches in the league. When you look at the experience, you know, he got to the NHL. You know, he coached for about 15 years before getting to the NHL. So he had done some trial and error at lower levels, and then you add in the experience of being around Anaheim and Detroit. You know, I think we're lucky. We have one of the top coaches in the league.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Detroit Red Wings general manager Ken Holland.
Ken, the NHL is obviously always tinkering with the game, especially during the offseason. Out of this lockout, there was obviously less changes than back in 2005. Are there any changes that the Detroit Red Wings or yourself personally would like to see implemented?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, the only thing I guess I've talked about this for 2-3 years is, you know, I'd like to see overtime a little longer, maybe 8 minutes, max 10 minutes, you know, maybe a 4-on-4 and a 3-on-3. I just think the more games you can decide playing hockey, ultimately I know the fans want to leave the rink and have a winner and a loser, and that's where the shootout comes in. But certainly when you look at parity, you know, a lot of time, I think there was a team last year that they were I can't remember if it was Minnesota or Dallas or somebody, but, you know, they didn't have a very good shootout record. And with a better shootout record, you would have made the playoffs. So, Colin Campbell and his Mike Murphy and the hockey ops coming out of 2005 have done a tremendous job in opening up the game and making it more entertaining for the fans, but continuing to keep the competitive side of the game and also trying to make the game as safe as possible for the players. So I think that the last 6, 7, 8 years have been the evolution of our game has been real positive. I think we got a great game. We got parity. I don't think there's really a lot to tinker with. I think they've got it down pretty good.
Ken, we'll let you go on this last question. Here in Winnipeg, we're all too familiar with the fact that the Jets do not play any road games within their own time zone, obviously being situated in the Southeast division this year. The Detroit Red Wings have a similar problem with Columbus being their only road opponent in the Eastern time zone. Especially in this abbreviated season, do you feel that this puts the Red Wings at a competitive disadvantage?
I think if you're somebody that's living in the East and playing in the East and you're used to riding a bike to your road games, you probably notice a difference. But, you know, we've lived it for so long. You know, starting on the 27th, and I'm sure Winnipeg's obviously going through the same thing. We know starting on the 27th of February, you know, we have five trips to the Western time zone. But, you know, we got our own plane, and again, I think, you know, once you're a young player and you're Henrik Zetterberg and Pavel Datsyuk is an example in Cronwell, and they come to our team, it is what it is, and it's you know what, you're up, you don't even think about it. We just jump on a plane, we go somewhere, and we play. So I don't really think so. I think that, we Mike Babcock tries to make sure that he finds rest wherever he can schedule, but obviously you prefer not to travel as much, but it is what it is. You gotta find ways to win games.
Detroit Red Wings General Manager Ken Holland, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Best of luck tomorrow in Chicago and on the season as a whole.
Thank you.
Take care, Ken. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 10 minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Detroit Red Wings General Manager Ken Holland for having just joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, we will make it available on our website, illegalcurve.com. It'll also be available on tsn1290.ca. And you can download the entire Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe to us on iTunes, and also available on illegalcurve.com. Just great insight from one of the probably the premier general manager in the NHL at this point?
I think when you're talking about premier general managers in the NHL, Ken Holland is in the mix. And for me, he's at the top of the list, but in the mix for sure for anybody. And I think what you have when he answered the questions that we asked, you have original thought. He's honest. And I think he's a great interview, smart guy and willing to express his opinion. And I think that's certainly appreciated from a radio perspective, but also from a hockey fan perspective.
Richie, this year obviously is another transition year. Your question to Ken Allen, you asked him about, you know, Stevie Yzerman when he retired and how that compares to Nicklas Lidström. When you listen to Ken Allen talk about the departures of Nicklas Lidström and Thomas Holmstrom, do you sense any panic in his voice or in the organization? Not at all. They always have a plan. Damian Brunner, they've added, who was playing with Henrik Zetterberg in Switzerland, and it looks like, you know, he's going to be a pretty good NHLer. There's never a panic in the organization. Sure, there's some big-time holes on defense, and now you've got Carlo Koliakovo, who's injured. Mm-hmm. I believe Ian White's out for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
So what do? They go out and sign Kent Huskins, a veteran defenseman. He was playing 20 minutes last night. They don't panic, and there's always a plan. This isn't a team that's expecting to not make the playoffs this year. The plan for them is to make the playoffs because that's what the Detroit Red Wings do.
The Jakob Kindle return also is important, and yeah. Bertuzzi obviously came back and scored a couple of goals. But I think also, Ezzy, what you have is an acknowledgement of the fact that there are some struggles ahead and there are some holes on the back end. He doesn't try and cover it up. He acknowledges that there's issues, yeah. that they need to be addressed, and that they cannot necessarily be, and they really can't, they can't be addressed immediately. So it'll take time, development, maybe some trades, maybe some signings down the road. But you know that the panic points to the fact that he won't mortgage any form of a long-term plan for a short-term fix.
And Richie, we didn't ask Ken Holland about this, but it's well documented. They went after Ryan Suter.
Yeah. Right.
And whether or not they got Ryan Suter, I mean, that, he's not going to make or break the entire season. He's going to make he's probably going to make them better, but I don't necessarily think that the Detroit Red Wings won't make the... I picked them to make the playoffs again this year. Some people thought this was going to be the year that they're finally going to really fall off. Nicklas Lidström, we've talked about this already early in the season, huge shoes or skates to fill. But you look at them, they won last night in Minnesota. They're getting it done.
I mean, I picked the Red Wings to make the playoffs too, but I also picked the Blackhawks not to, so I got to be forthright.
Only four games into the season.
I haven't given you the gears yet. It's funny. It's funny how
somebody on Twitter was.
I know.
It's funny. I was actually, quickly, I know we got to move on here, but I was talking to Hustler about this. Hustler was listening to our season preview show, and he was saying, you know what? I was loving your guys' show until Richie picked the Blackhawks to not make the playoffs when Ezzy picked the Blackhawks to win the Cup. But, you know, that's the way it is. Parody, Ken Holland talked about it himself. Short season, you know, a team like the Blackhawks, they're competing with a lot of teams. So
the truth also is, Drew, before we transition, the truth is things don't always go as you think that they will. And so the teams that everybody expects to make the playoffs, there's always a few changes. And as Ken spoke about, parity. And so it's very hard to predict what's going to happen from 10 games to the next, from the Jets' first game to their fourth, from one team to the next. I mean, the team that Vancouver looked awful against Anaheim, the first game, they looked great last night.
That discussion was a little preview of our new show starting February the 6th, Wednesday, February the 6th, 6 to 8 every Wednesday night, Hockey Midweek, NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, where we're going to be covering the NHL from the perspective of all the other 29 teams in the league. So you can look forward to that coming up in about 2 weeks' time starting here on TSN 1290. Gentlemen, let's look ahead to the Jets schedule for this following week. Obviously, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on TSN 1290 is Puck Drop. Pre-game coverage starts with us, actually, 3 o'clock, and then Rick Ralph joins with the official Winnipeg Jets pregame show at 6 o'clock. Jets Islanders tomorrow night. Following that, Tuesday in Montreal, and then Thursday, Friday in Florida and Tampa Bay. Obviously, the Jets are at a high after that win last night against Pittsburgh. All the more important to back that up with a win tomorrow at home against the Islanders. Otherwise, it almost makes the Pittsburgh win for naught. But if you can say, if you had said at the beginning of last Saturday that after five games the Jets would be 3-1-1 if they take care of business tomorrow night, every Jets fan would take that.
Let's say right off the bat that every game is important, but certain games are even more important, especially when they're followed by, preceded by big-time wins, obviously, including yesterday against the Penguins. But, yeah, they got to win tomorrow's game because they've got a nicely scheduled couple days here. But then next Thursday and Friday on the road, they've got the Lightning and Panthers back-to-back in Florida. And we know that those back-to-back games are hard. So you got to assume that it's going to be tough to get 3 out of 4 points out of those two games. So, the Jets had trouble in Montreal and in Florida last year, specifically the Panthers. Obviously, they play Tampa next Friday, but they had trouble against the Panthers last year. So tomorrow, you're facing an Islanders team that's improving, lots of offensive weapons. They can score. They scored 7 goals against the Leafs, and hey, there might be goaltending problems, but the Islanders are... The funny thing is, Richie, the Islanders, everyone looks at John Tavares and the top line, and the Islanders are actually a pretty hard team to play against. I know you really like Franz Nielsen, but you look at the team right now, and they play pretty well as a team. They remind me a little, they're not as talented as Nashville, but they remind me of a team that plays good 5-on-5, and they're not an easy win anymore.
And we're going to get in depth into the Islanders roster tomorrow.
That's right.
But to that point, Ezzy, I agree. I think for Jack Capuano, one thing that I noticed last year, and I've said it on the show, I think a couple weeks ago, they play hard. They play hard for Jack Capuano, and that says something about him because that means that the team believes believes in what he's selling, in my opinion.
Exactly right. If the Jets take care of business tomorrow and they're able to defeat the Islanders, you can sort of accept a bit of a letdown on Tuesday against Montreal, as long as they back it up Thursday, Friday. If you had to pick, you know, the key games on the schedule for the coming week, I think are Thursday, Friday, Tampa Bay and Miami, more so than say Montreal on Tuesday, strictly because those are divisional games versus the Habs, which is just sort of another game on the schedule.
Every game is important, but the divisional games are more important because you can slide into the three slot if you do win your division. So yeah, Drew, those are important. I think the best, I like Montreal this year. I picked them as my surprise team for the playoffs. I think they're more talented than some have given them credit for, and with Subban or not, and we'll talk about that later, they're a formidable opponent. I think Tampa is the best team in the division, and I like to see how the Jets match up against Tampa. That's the game I'm most interested in seeing this week.
Well, the guys, they've got Florida next Thursday, and then Florida comes back into Winnipeg the following Tuesday, February 5th. You know, and to me, that's, you know, we talk about the division games, and specifically, that's the one team that I think has fallen off in that division, the Southeast Division, and I think that's a team that it really surprised me the way the Florida plays, because you look at Florida's defense, and they've lost Garrison, but you know, Campbell and Jovanovski, and they've got a pretty good defensive unit there, and the Jets are going to have to beat a team like Florida if they want to have any chance at making the playoffs, because we know. Most likely, you know, Tampa's going to be there, and at least one of two of Carolina and Washington. At least, you know, I see this little early start by Washington. Washington is just a blip. You guys might disagree with me, but I still have them as the top team in the division. But, you know, you've got Florida, Tampa at the end of next week. These are important. The Jets haven't played very many division games so far, and these are the ones that are going to matter. And the good news for Jets fans is that they were good in their own division last year. The only team they didn't really play well against last year was Florida.
Absolutely right. And, I mean, so you look ahead to that, and it just does make it all that more key. And then tomorrow night, again, I can't stress it enough, it's such an opportunity for a letdown. And, I mean, we saw it sort of last year. I remember there was that big Friday night victory against the Washington Capitals, if I'm not mistaken. Might have been even the Crosby's Better game, where the crowd chanted that. The Jets were able to defeat the Capitals and really kept themselves in the playoff race. Then Sunday, the Carolina Panthers came to town. Carolina Hurricanes came to town.
How did Cam Newton perform?
Yeah, exactly. The Carolina Hurricanes came to town on that Sunday. This is back when the Hurricanes were really struggling last year. And the Jets couldn't match that emotional effort from Friday night and lost a winnable game on home ice that really, from my perspective, really might have been the death knell for the Jets and their playoff opportunities last year. So it'll be a good sign, it'll be a good barometer to see if this Jets team is more mature and understands how to win on a night-in, night-out basis.
Yep.
When the emotion levels might differ from one game to the next.
And they're on a high right now.
But they can't get too high
exactly.
And mighty.
Exactly, and they know that. They you can bet that Claude Noel and Perry Perrin and Charlie Huddy are telling them that. I mean, obviously, you know, you don't want to get too excited, but people were saying that was the best game in Jets 2.0 history. And you know what? It was a good game. I don't know. I don't want to get too excited here because there were some big wins last year against some pretty good hockey teams. But it's very important to keep your emotions in check when you're on a high, and you're already starting to think about where your record's at 2-1-1. You got to almost treat every game individually, but also as if it's every team is the same in that you got to do what you got to do to get the win. And again, the Islanders, we're going to preview the game more tomorrow at Boston Pizza when we do Hustler and Lawless. But this Islanders team is, I think, a few players away from being a really good team. I think their forwards are still, you know, you've still got some work to go. But, you know, they've got Keith O'Coin there who had a couple goals last night. But they're going to be a challenge for the Jets, and you got to get the crowd into it early because they didn't get the crowd into it early yesterday. But it's not going to be an easy game, Drew.
Coverage of tomorrow's Jets Islanders game begins with us at 3 o'clock live from Boston Pizza City Place. Rick Ralph and the official Winnipeg Jets pregame show at 6, and then Brian Munns with the call starting at 7 p.m. tomorrow. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to discuss some of the contracts signed this week in the NHL. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Coming up in about 30 minutes' time, Anthony Sanfilippo from the PhiladelphiaFlyers.com is going to join us to talk about the Flyers. Before then, there's been a number of signings in the NHL this week. We want to go through those and discuss, well, share our thoughts with about some of them. Let's start in Toronto, where I believe it was last Sunday morning, the Toronto Maple Leafs signed Joffrey Leupel to a 5-year, $26.25 million contract extension.
It's a nice little Sunday morning.
For Joffrey Leupel, especially.
I was just, sleeping in.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I'm glad to hear it. justify that contract for me, because from my perspective, it's really just a bizarre decision by the Maple Leafs front office staff.
I guess you say bizarre, but I mean... Joffrey Leupel, after having several years of injury problems, Richie, in Anaheim, comes to Toronto, and he fit with Phil Kessel. It worked out well for him, and he had his best year ever, and he's being rewarded for having essentially a comeback breakout season, whatever you want to call it. And the money that he got, maybe it was a little bit high. To me, a guy like him, that's maybe around what you pay a guy like that. But he obviously has got this injury, and he's going to be out for a month and a half, something like that. So it's
6 weeks minimum.
So terrible timing. But they obviously have decided that they want to lock him up. So, I mean, is it a good or bad signing? I don't necessarily know. It's bizarre because he obviously performed well for them, and he's being rewarded for that.
I mean, I don't really get it, Drew. You're looking at Joffrey Leupel, a guy who is 29 years old.
Can't stay healthy.
29 years old, you've locked him up through the 2017-2018 season. In his career, he's never had more than 67 points. Granted, he had over a point a game last year in the time that he did play, but he's never had more than 67 points. On two occasions, has he ever scored more than 25 goals in a National Hockey League season? He's scored more than 20 goals three times. He's never been really an assist guy. Last year, obviously, had more assists, but generally speaking, his assist-to-goal ratio was fairly equal. So you look at all of those factors, and you look at what he's being paid, 5.25 a year. Well, Phil Kessel's up after next season. I mean, that obviously sets a benchmark for him to get far in excess of that. And you're setting the market, obviously, for other players. This is how the NHL obviously works, is that they complain about the contracts that are handed out. I mean, that the contracts are escalating when you pay a guy like Joffrey Leupel on that term. I think the term might even be more of an issue with his injury history. Both of it I don't really like. Comparables. CapGeek.com provides some comparables in terms of cap hit and who he's similar to in terms of money. And even term. You know, let me read some names. Okay, now he's older, so he's, UFA eligible. That obviously increases his leverage.
Right. They acquired him so he doesn't hit the unrestricted free agency market.
I'll just read some names in terms of comparables. Yeah, Vander Kane, obviously younger. Vander Kane, David Krejci, Jamie Benn, Jeff Carter, Marian Hossa, Shane Doan, Jason Pominville, Bobby Ryan, Phil Kessel, Grabowski's teammate, Alex Hemsky, James Neal. So you look at, and there's more. But you look at all those names, and I'm not sure if there's anybody on that list that you'd take Leupel over.
Let me ask you guys this question. They signed him at the beginning of this year. He becomes a free agent at the end of this year. He had been scheduled to become a free agent at the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Joffrey Leupel in May,
mm-hmm.
and we don't expect the Leafs to make the playoffs, so their season ends at the end of April. You go to him before he's 2 months before he's going to hit free agency,
mm-hmm.
and you offer him this deal. Does he turn it down at that point in time?
No.
So why the rush to sign him to this deal when, A, you don't know if he's going to be healthy, and obviously he isn't, as it happened after he broke his forearm a game after he signed the contract.
Just bad timing.
But obviously bad timing, and that's fluke. And then B, I just don't get what the rush is for the Leafs to do it, to see if he's even going to match the output that he had last year, which would have been his career year, with over a point a game.
Drew, I bet Richie would agree with me and saying, okay, if he's going to become a UFA, and you know that there's teams out there that might want to pick him up and spend, $4.5-5 million to pick him up, okay, you sign him, but why not sign him to 2 years? Why not sign him to 2 or 3 years? Why give him 5 years? And I, in that sense, Richie, I agree with you that it's the thing is, you know, we've been doing the show for a while, and we analyze contracts, especially, you know, during the off season when guys sign deals. And, you know, your average player in the NHL makes $2.5 million. So if you're a 25, 60 point guy, that's what you get paid. I mean, look at Nikolai Antropov now, is a 40 point player, but when he had his best season, the Thrashers gave him $4 million a year. So 5 years later, now a guy like Nikolai Antropov gets $5 million a year coming off a season. Mm-hmm. So the way I look at it, okay, he makes $5 million a year, but I'm agreeing with you, Richie. I mean, he's, you know, even though he's getting rewarded, you have to a little bit, you know, wonder why they're committing to him that long.
I mean, again, you're giving this guy 5 years, $26.25 million. Doesn't make sense to me. Never been a huge Joffrey Lupo fan. He's a nice player. Not a bad player. He can fit in your top six. But is he worth that much money in that term? Not in my books.
Let's compare that with the other five-year, $26.25 million contract that was signed this week. That's Jamie Benn in Dallas. Now, granted, Jamie Benn in Dallas was a restricted free agent. He's younger. He did not have the leverage that Joffrey Lupo had. He was not about to hit unrestricted free agency. He was an unsigned player at this point in time.
He's a 3-year free agent, just like Evander Kane was this past offseason. So exactly. He was not arbitration eligible, and he is 4 years away. He's 4 years away from, he's 4 years away from being a UFA.
So the Dallas Stars bought out 1 year of his unrestricted free agency in a manner similar to how the Jets did with Evander Kane. Same exact sort of contract situation that was surrounding this. Is there any way that, you know, Joffrey Lupo should be worth the same amount as Jamie Benn?
Well, no, you're talking about a guy who, Richie, is, first off, he's their number one center and he's entering his prime years. But, I mean, if we're looking at it, apples and apples, the guy, you know, he's an emerging star, Jamie Benn. The Jamie Benn contract was a little bit difficult for Joe Nieuwendyk because of the fact that he wanted a little bit higher, just the way it always is with an RFA. Evander Kane, obviously, there were some difficulties with signing with the Jets, but no, I mean, he's not worth as much money. I mean, Jamie Benn is the type of guy that he could score 80 points for the next 10 years. He's that talented, and he does a lot for the Dallas Stars. So, I mean, that contract, it's good that they got that done because they need him out there.
You're a Jamie Benn fan.
I'm a Jamie Benn fan. I have been for quite a while. Just so much offensive talent, so gifted, so great with the puck, such great vision. So I'm a big fan of what Jamie Benn brings to the table. Comparing them is a little bit apples to oranges in their contract situations, and that Joffrey Lupo would be free to the market to anybody who wanted him, whereas Benn really had no leverage aside from offer sheet leverage, and that seems an offer sheet seems like something that would be quite rare coming out of the most recent lockout. I would be hard-pressed to see an owner, maybe James Dolan, but I would be hard-pressed to see any owner going up and signing an offer sheet after such a battle and protracted negotiations with the players. In terms of the contract, you know, we talk about the market and what's the market set at. He got about market value for, you know, you look at Evander Kane, he signed for the exact same amount as Evander Kane. As you mentioned, Drew, 5-year deal as opposed to a 6-year deal. But, you know, you could argue who's better. Kane, better goal scorer. Ben's a center, a little bit better, a better playmaker. If all these guys had negotiated in a vacuum, would they all be slightly overpaid, in my opinion? Yeah, probably, but contracts like Jeff Skinner throw everything out of kilter, and that's the problem.
Do you have any problem with this Jamie Benn contract?
No. I mean, taken for what it is, based on the other contracts that have been signed, I'm fine with it. Do I think the NHL has a problem with giving second contracts in years that they have lots of leverage? Yes, I do.
And it's not going
to change, and I just have to come to live with it, but I do have, and we're going to talk about P.K. Subban, but I do have respect for the fact that Marc Bergevin, and you have to understand the differences, though, quickly. I'm going to compare the two. When you're Marc Bergevin and you're Joe Nieuwendyk, there's a huge difference. Joe Nieuwendyk,
aside from the fact that he's a new GM.
Joe Nieuwendyk has signed Jaromir Jagr and Ray Whitney. And Whitney's on a 2-year, and Jagr's on a 1-year, if I'm correct.
Yeah, you're right.
But the point is, you don't sign those guys unless you want to make a dent and get back in the playoffs. And your problem is, if you sign those guys and don't sign Jamie Benn, It's like the old New York Rangers back in the late 90s when they signed a bunch of guys to compliment Mark Messier and then didn't sign Mark Messier. And you can't do it that way. Whereas with the Habs, you have a young, emerging, developing team. Subban's essentially been replaced by Andre Markov on the back end, and you have solid goaltending. And the expectations of the team and the fans are such that while it is Montreal, they understand it's a long-term process. So,
hang on, stop there for a second and explain why Markov has replaced Subban so far this year.
Well, I mean, he provides the offensive capabilities.
But I meant so because Markov was injured all of last year.
He was injured all of last year, and so if he stays healthy, you're basically dropping him in and taking and Subban out. Now, obviously, you're better with both of them. But the expectations are huge things. So Joel Nieuwendyk, not necessarily a bad thing, but Joel Nieuwendyk, by signing Jagr and by signing Whitney, basically put himself between a rock and a hard place that he had to sign Jamie Benn.
You have to. And, you know, those signings are as much to do with getting back into the playoffs as it is getting fans back in the seats, because, as we know, Dallas has had trouble getting fans in the seats. And, again, you got to sign Jamie Benn because he's become a fan favorite. He's become one of your top offensive players alongside Louis Erickson. So they had to sign him, and they probably wanted to have signed him before the season started. It didn't happen, but Richie's right. Dallas, there's pressure in Dallas. Dallas has been out of the playoffs, and they were close last year, but they didn't make it. They're trying to make a run at the playoffs. They didn't sign Jaromir Jagr for the next 5 years. I mean, Jaromir Jagr's coming in for 1 year. And so, yeah, I mean, Jamie Benn got market value again when you're, you know, in your early 20s coming out of your year out of your entry level deal. You're going to get in between 5.5-6 million. That's kind of what the Jeff Skinner, Tyler Seguin, Evander Kane, that class of player is getting. So, but yeah, I agree with Richie though. He's a great player to watch. I'm kind of excited to see if Jamie Benn can make the 2014 Canadian Olympic team. I think he's kind of just on the perimeter there of guys, but I'd like to see him make it.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to discuss Vancouver signing Alex Edler to a contract extension. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 20 minutes past the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, our good friend Anthony Sanfilippo from the PhiladelphiaFlyers.com is going to join us.
Very excited about that.
I know. Anthony's been one of our longest-term guests and one of our most frequent guests over the years on this program. Let's continue on talking about some of the contract situations that are still outstanding this year. Alex Edler re-signed with the Vancouver Canucks.
Yep.
6 years, $30 million for the Canucks defenseman. What was your immediate thoughts on that deal?
I like the deal, Drew. I mean, it's provided his back holds up, and I'm assuming Mike Gillis and Lawrence Gilman did their due diligence there to ensure that he is healthy and ready to go. But you're getting a defenseman who can skate, who can hit hard, who's built like a truck, and can move the puck and create offense. That's two different things to me, you know, in terms of in the offensive zone and on the power play. So if you can lock up a guy like that to $5 million a year and not have to dip into the UFA market, I think you're doing really well. I like his game. I'm more than happy if I'm Vancouver with this contract. In fact, I think you might have even got a little bit of a deal.
Richie, 3 or 4 years ago, coming out of Manitoba in the AHL, everybody remembers watching Edler. He played one season here. You know, he came in under, you know, Sammy Salow and Matthias Olund, and Bieksa was already there. And then, you know, in that cup run against Boston, where they lost, obviously, but he became their number one defenseman. He's their number one defenseman now, and he's still at a fairly young age to become that number one defenseman. And Edler is so talented. He's unbelievable. He's become one of the top offensive defensemen in the NHL, and you know he deserves that contract. And you know with Jason Garrison being signed, you've already got Bieksa there. You know, Hamhuis and Ballard, there's some talk that one of those guys might get moved. But, you know, that you got to sign Alex Edler. And that seems like a, you know, Richie says it's a deal. And for a guy that talented, it probably is a deal.
Let me ask you guys this question. Alex Edler, obviously, he's older than Zach Bogosian. He's 26 years old. So he had, he was a restricted free agent.
He was a pending UFA this year, Drew.
Was he a pending UFA after, I guess this would be his seventh year in the league, right?
I believe, well, he'd be 27. I believe that I'm almost sure he would be a pending UFA and in a market that had little to any top-end defenseman. He would have cracked far more than that on the UFA market, in my opinion.
You talk about the Pittsburgh Penguins needing a defenseman. You don't think they're going to scoop up an Alex Edler and try to sign him for a multi-year deal? So that's probably why. You mentioned, Drew, the urgency with Leupel, not really any urgency there, but there is some urgency with Edler. They don't want to have to worry about a contract situation next year.
Especially as in Richard's estimation that they do get a bit of a deal on it by signing him, you know, prior to him hitting unrestricted free agency.
You have to be, look at that. He's a pending UFA. He would be a pending UFA this summer.
Will this contract cost Zach Bogosian money when the Jets try and negotiate with him this offseason? Now, obviously, different situations in that one was going to be a UFA and one is just going to be an RFA, albeit an arbitration-eligible RFA. But, you know, based on this deal, is this going to cost future defensemen, maybe this offseason, maybe next offseason, a little bit of money?
But you might ask that question in a little bit of a different way about Carl Alsner's contract last year when he signed for a very minimal amount and he was in a more of a restricted free agent. Obviously, he was a younger defenseman. But every situation is just so different. I mean, to me, the GMs don't use the comparables enough, and they worry more about their markets and things like that. And I understand that, the pressures that they have, etc. But if you're Kevin Cheveldayoff now, Edler is more proven. He has produced more offensively. Maybe his health's a little more of an issue. But for a pending UFA to get $5 million a year with no arbitration eligibility, you have to use that. You know, in terms of leverage if you're the Jets. But at the same time, they may say, hey, you know, Bogosian likes being here. He's taking steps in the right direction. We don't really care. We're going to give him a little more. Or, you know, if you give him $5 million over 4 years, right? Say you give him $5 million over 4 years, right? Because Bogosian will have 2 years left until he's a UFA.
Then you can sign him to a six-year deal if you want.
But then, you know, then that's what that changes. But if you give him a four-year deal and you give him $5 million a year, you're paying him more than the UFA years that Edler got. So if you use it the right leverage, but at the same time, Drew, for every contract there is like that, there's a stupid contract you can use.
You mentioned Carl Alsner, who's a young defenseman for the Washington Capitals. And, you know, Drew, you asked the question about Alex Edler and how that's going to impact, you know, Zach Bogosian, you know, negotiating with the Jets. I think, like, the P.K. Subban contract, which obviously hasn't happened yet, that contract and the Drew Doughty contract, obviously Doughty and Bogosian were drafted in the same year, but Doughty has emerged as a much better defenseman earlier in their career. But you're looking at Bogosian, and he's just going to get better and better. And it's bad timing that he got the injury this year when he's up for a contract, because if he ends up playing 20 games, I mean, how are you going to judge how well he's done? Mm-hmm. You have to really use last year when he had 30 points and he really improved and started playing top 4 minutes.
So this could be another, sorry for interrupting there, yeah, Ezzie, this could be another bridge contract for Zach Bogosian, much like the previous one was a sort of a 2-year bridge contract.
I think what Richie's getting at is he's thinking Bogosian might get 4 years, and I guess you could call that a bridge contract. The bridge contract, I think general managers of the NHL like to use the Matt Duchene contract is the bridge contract.
I think he's had his bridge contract. I think his next contract's a long one. I think it's longer than 4 years, probably. You're looking at 5 to 6 years kind of for his next deal. Maybe 4 years, 4 to 6 years, and obviously, I mean, that'd be a more predictable term in any event. But the amount of money, what he ends up receiving, will be very interesting. And I was thinking about this yesterday, you know, how, and you've mentioned it, Ezzie, how do you judge Zach Bogosian's value, especially on a shortened season when it's even shorter for him because of his injuries? And then how do you judge the overall talent? You've had the talent for 82 games last year or so, and I forget how many games he exactly played. And then you have this year's sample, which may be 30 games. So you have 110 games. Sure, that gives you an idea of the player. It gives you a very good idea of the player. But when you're talking about big term, big dollars, you have to be certain that he's going to provide at least the value of that contract, if not excess value. So the Bogosian contract to me is the most interesting issue heading into the Jets offseason when we get there.
Well, let's look at the current Jets defensemen and what they're under contract for. Bufflin makes $5.2 million for a cap hit, and starting next year, Tobias Enstrom is going to make $5.75 million as a cap hit. You can't put Bogosian higher than Bufflin or Enstrom, can you?
No, and you can't at his age, and he's not. I mentioned Drew Doughty and P.K. Subban, and I probably would put Bogosian a little bit closer to P.K. Subban in talent level, even though I think Subban's a little bit higher, at least now. But I don't think you can give him $5 million a year right now, but that's just my opinion. But he might maybe be asking for 3.5 to 4.5. Richie's the expert. He's going to have to do an article on Legal Curve.
Well, and I thought about actually doing that, but I don't think you can do that article yet until you see what Bogosian does this year. because it's going to be a small sample size, but it still will have some form of a predictive element in terms of what he is to receive. I do agree, Drew, though, that you can't pay him right now over what Bufflin or Enstrom are making. Enstrom was a pending UFA, as Edler just resigned, although he's not as good defensively as Edler. And you could argue he's better offensively, though. In terms of Bufflin, arguably the second best offensive defenseman in the National Hockey League, aside from the brilliant Erik Karlsson. But also, Bufflin's 27, too. So there are differences in all of these negotiations. But yes, at this point in time, I don't think you can pay him more than those guys. I think if you're looking at five, you're looking at kind of maxing out at five in a contract that's three to 4 to 5, 6 years.
Well, if it's a five-year deal, are you going somewhere between 20 and 25 million? Probably closer to 20?
I think the question is, where in there does the contract land as opposed to if it's there?
But because by all accounts, I mean, even if you only play, you know, let's say he plays 20 games this year,
mm-hmm.
and we're speculating, it could be more. Jets fans would hope it's going to be more.
It's not going to be more than 30.
Well, it's unlikely it's going to be more than 30. But so let's say you have a 110-game sample, you have a 100-game sample, and he plays at the same level that he played last year.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a five-year, you know, $20 million deal, somewhere around there, give or take?
More, I think. I have to look into it further.
Yeah.
But if I had to guess, I'd say you'd be between the 23 and 25 range.
So almost up to, on an AAV, of what Edler's making.
And now, the article I would do would be on based on actual value, not on what I think they'll pay him. Those are always two different things, too, right?
Right.
So I would guess, before having evaluated it too much, he'd be more in the 22.5 to 23 range. But I think it'll probably end up in the 25 range.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, Anthony Sanfilippo from the PhiladelphiaFlyers.com is going to join us.